The Count had at that moment temporarily found his feet and replaced his helmet on his head. Standing on the high platform of the rolls, his voice, powered with adrenaline and shrill with terror, carried clearly to every gunner. "Open fire!" shrieked the Count. "Open fire immediately, or I will have you all shot!" And then, realizing that they should be encouraged to remain at their posts and cover his withdrawal, he reached frantically for inspiration and flung over his shoulder one rousing, "Death before dishonour!" before the rolls bore him away, still at 60 miles an hour, towards the long-distant horizon. The Major lifted his voice in a great bugling bellow to countermand the order, but even his lungs were no match for the thunderous volley of 9 field guns, fired in as close to unison as they'd ever been in training. Each gunner took his colonel at his literal word when he said immediately, and such refinements as laying and aiming were forgotten in the dire urgency of firing as furiously and as fast as possible. In the circumstances, it was nothing short of a miracle that one high-explosive shell found a mark. This was a Fiat troop carrier which had emerged at that moment from the dust clouds a quarter of a mile behind the Ethiopian armoured car. The shell was fused to a thousandth of a second delay. It went in through the radiator, shattered the engine block, disintegrated the driver, then burst in the midst of the group of terrified infantrymen huddled under the canvas hood. The engine and front wheel of the truck kept going forwards for a few seconds before beginning to roll and bounce over the irregular ground. The rest of the truck and 20 men went straight upwards, 50 feet in the air, like a troop of maniacal acrobats. Only one other shell came close to hitting the enemy. It burst 10 yards in front of the hump, erupting in a towering pillar of flame and yellow earth, and gouging a deep round crater 4 feet across, into which the speeding car plunged. The Russ, whose head was protruding from the turret, and whose mouth and eyes were wide open, had all three of these body apertures filled with flying sand from the explosion, and his war whoops were cut off abruptly as he choked for breath and tried frantically to wipe his streaming eyes. Gareth also had his vision abruptly closed by the pillar of flame and sand, and he drove blindly into the shell crater. The impact threw him out of his seat, and the steering wheel hit him in his chest, driving the wind out of his lungs before snapping off, short at the floorboards. With another bound, the hump bounced jauntily out of the shell crater, with streamers of dust and shell smoke swirling about it. She was hanging over on one side with her springs snapped off by the jolt and her front wheels locked firmly to one side, yet her engine still bellowed at full power, and she went into a tight right-hand circle, around and around like a circus animal. Wheezing for breath, Gareth dragged himself back into the driver's seat, only to find that there was no longer a steering column and that the throttle had jammed at the fully open position. He sat there for long seconds, shaking his head to clear it and struggling desperately for breath, for the hull was filled with dust and smoke. Another shell, bursting somewhere close behind the hull, roused him from the stupors of shock, and he reached up, unlatched the driver's hatch, and stuck his head out into the open air. At what seemed like point-blank range, 3 full batteries of Italian field guns were firing at him. "Oh, my God!" he gasped painfully, as another volley of high explosive erupted around the rapidly circling car, the blast jarring his eyeballs and rattling his teeth in his head. "Let's go home," he said, and began to hoist himself out of the narrow hatchway. His feet came clear of the steel flooring of the hull, only just in time to save every bone beneath his knees in both legs from being shattered into small fragments. 2,000 yards away, across the plain, Major Castellani was fighting for control against the panic that the Count had instilled in his gunners. They were loading and firing with such single-minded passion that all the other refinements of gunnery were completely forgotten. The layers were no longer making a pretense at seeking a target, but merely jerking the lanyard at every moment the breech block clanged shut. Castellani's bellows made no impression on the half-deafened and almost completely dazed gunners. The Count's last injunction to death had shattered their nerves completely, and they were all of them beyond reason. Castellani dragged the nearest layer from his seat behind the gun shield and prized open the man's death grip on the lanyard. Cursing bitterly at the quality of the men under his command, he pedalled the traverse and elevating handles of the gun with a smooth, expert action. The thick barrel dropped and swung until the insect speck of the armoured car loomed suddenly large in the magnifying prism of the gun sight. It was tearing in a crazy circle, clearly out of control, and Castellani picked up the rhythm of its circle and hit the lanyard with a short, hard jerk of the wrist. The barrel flew back, arrested at last by the hydraulic pistons of the shock absorber, and the 15-pound cone-shaped steel shell was hurled on an almost flat trajectory across the plain. It was aimed fractionally low. It passed inches below the tall, shuttered bows of the car, between the two front wheels, and struck the earth directly below the driver's compartment. The released energy of the blast was deflected by the earth's surface up into the soft underbelly of the hull. It blew the engine block off its seating, tore off the big front wheels like wings from a roast chicken, and stove in the steel floor of the hull with a great Thor's hammer stroke. If Gareth Swales's feet had been in contact with the steel floor of the hull, the shock would have been transmitted directly into the bones of his feet and legs, and he would have suffered that dreadful but characteristic wound of the tank man. Below the knees, his legs would have been transformed into bags of shattered bone. He was, however, suspended half in and half out of the driver's hatch, with both legs kicking frantically in the air, and the shock of the blast came up like carbon dioxide in a bottle of freshly opened champagne. He was the cork, and he was shot out of the hatch, still kicking. The effect on the Russ was the same. He came out of the turret, propelled high by the blast, and he met Gareth at the top of his trajectory. The two of them came down to earth simultaneously, with the Russ seated between Gareth's shoulder blades. And the wonder of it was that neither of them was impaled upon the war sword, which went with them and finally pegged deep into the earth, 6 inches from Gareth's ear, as he lay face down and feebly tried to dislodge the Russ from his back. "I warn you, old chap," he managed to gasp. "One day you're going to go too far." The sound of oncoming engines, many of them, and all roaring in high revolutions, made Gareth's efforts to dislodge the Russ more determined. He sat up, spitting sand and blood from his crushed lips, and looked up to see the remaining Italian transports bearing down on them like the starting grid of the Le Mans Grand Prix. "Oh, my God!" gasped Gareth, his scattered wits reassembling hastily, and he crawled frantically into the shattered and still smoking carcass of the hump, beginning to shrink down out of sight before he realised that the Russ was no longer with him. "Russy, you stupid old bastard! Come back!" he shouted despairingly. The Russ, once again armed with his trusty broadsword, was staggering out on unsteady stork's legs, stunned by the shell burst but still fighting mad, and there was no doubting his intentions. He was going to take on the entire motorised column single-handed. And as he hurried to meet them, shouting a challenge, he loosened up with a few hissing two-handed cuts with the sword. Gareth had to duck under the swinging blade, going in low in a flying rugby tackle to bring the old warrior down in an untidy heap. He dragged him, still shouting and struggling furiously, under the cover of the broken steel hull, just as the first Italian truck roared past them. The pale-faced occupants paid them not the slightest attention. They were intent on one thing only, and that was following their colonel. "Shut up," growled Gareth, as the Russ tried to provoke them with some of the foulest oaths in the Amharic language. Finally, he had to hold the Russ down, wrap his shammer round his head and sit on it, while the Italian Fiats thundered past and the rolling clouds of dust spread over them as though driven by the Khamsin. Once through the dust and confused stampede of trucks, Gareth thought he glimpsed the humpbacked shape of Priscilla the pig, and he released the Russ for a moment to wave and shout, but the car disappeared almost instantly, hard on the trail of a lumbering Fiat, and Gareth heard the short crashing burst of the Vickers clearly, even above the thunder of many engines. Then suddenly they were all past, streaming away, the engine sounds fading, the dust settling. And then there was another sound, faint yet growing with every second. Although most of the Harari and Gala horsemen had long ago given up the pursuit in favour of the more enjoyable and profitable occupation of looting the capsized and damaged Italian trucks, a few hundred of the more hardy souls still flogged on their foundering mounts. This thin line of horsemen came sweeping forward, ululating and casually cutting down the Italian survivors from the destroyed trucks who fled before them on foot. "All right, Rassie," Gareth unwound the chamois from around his head. "You can come out now. Call your boys up and tell them to get us out of here." In the few moments of respite, while the main body of motorized infantry came through the batteries, Major Castellani hurried from gun to gun, lashing with tongue and cane until he had contained the infectious panic of his gunners and had them under his hand again. Then, out of the dust clouds, appearing at short pistol range as suddenly as a ghost ship, but with the Vickers machine gun and its turret crackling wickedly, and the muzzle blast flickering in an angry, throbbing red glow, was a second Ethiopian armoured car. It was enough to destroy the semblance of control that Castellani had forced heavy-handedly upon the gun crews, as the armoured car swung across their line at point-blank range, raking the exposed guns with a withering burst of machine gun fire. The loaders dropped their ready shells and almost knocked the layers from their seats in their anxiety to get behind the armoured shield of the gun. They all huddled there, with their heads well down. The driver of the armoured car, after that one rapid pass down the front of the batteries, swung the vehicle abruptly back into the screen of dust. Jake had been just as startled by the encounter as were the gunners. At one moment, he'd been joyously tearing along after a fat, wallowing Fiat, and at the next, he'd emerged from a cloud of dust to be confronted by the gaping muzzles of the big guns. "My God, Greg!" Jake shouted up at the boy in the turret. "We nearly ran right into them." "Volleyed and thundered. You remember the poem?" "Poetry at a time like this," growled Jake, and he gave Priscilla the throttle. "Where are we going?" "Home, and the sooner the quicker." "That's a powerful argument. They're pointing at us." "Jake!" Gregorius began to protest. When there was a bang and a flash that glowed briefly, even through the shrouds of dust, and close beside the turret passed a 100-meter shell. The air slammed against their eardrums, and the shriek of it made them both flinch violently. The air stank of the electric sizzle of its passing, and it burst half a mile beyond them in a tall tower of flame and dust. "You see what I mean?" asked Jake. "Oh, yes, Jake, yes, indeed." As he spoke, the dust clouds that had covered them so securely now subsided and drifted aside, exposing them unmercifully to the attentions of the Italian guns. But revealed also was another tempting target. The Ethiopian cavalry was still coming on, and after a few futile volleys, had burst around the tiny, elusive shape of the speeding car. Castellani resigned himself to the limitations of his gunners and switched targets. "Shrapnel!" he bellowed. "Load with shrapnel! Fuse for airburst!" He hurried along the battery, repeating the order to each layer, emphasizing his orders with a cane. "New target, massed horsemen. Range, 2,500 meters. Fire at will." The Ethiopian ponies were small, shaggy beasts, bred for sure-footed ascent of mountain paths, rather than sustained charges across open plains. They had, moreover, been pastured for weeks now on the dry, sour grass of the desert, and in consequence their strength was by this time almost expended. The first shrapnel burst 50 feet above the heads of the leading riders. It popped open like a gigantic pod of the cotton plant, blooming with sudden fearsome splendour against the milky blue sky. It bloomed with a crack as though the sky had shattered, and instantly the air was filled with the humming, hissing knives of flying shrapnel. A dozen of the ponies went down under the first burst, pitching forward abruptly over their own heads and flinging their riders free. Then the sky was filled with the deadly cotton balls, and the continuous crack of the bursts sent the ponies wheeling and the riders crouching low on their withers or swinging out of the saddle to hang low under the bellies of their mounts. Here and there, a braver soul would kick his feet free of the stirrups and pick up a dismounted comrade on each of the leathers, the gallant little ponies labouring under their triple burdens. Within seconds, the entire Ethiopian army, its single remaining armoured vehicle, and all its cavalry, were in a retreat every bit as headlong as that of the motorised Italian column, which was still on its way back to the wells of Chaldi. The field was left entirely to Castellani's artillery and the stranded crew of the Hump. From the shelter of the shattered hull, Gareth Swales watched his hopes of quick rescue fading rapidly, first in the shape of the dwindling cavalry. "Don't blame them. Not really," he told the Ras. And then he looked across at the speeding armoured car. Priscilla the Pig was rapidly overhauling the cavalry. "Him I do," he muttered. "He saw us. I know he did." There had been a moment when Priscilla the Pig had passed within a quarter of a mile of them, had in fact turned directly towards them for a few moments. "Do you know something, Rassy, old fellow? I do believe we're being set up for a couple of patsies." He glanced at the Ras, who lay beside him, like an old hunting dog that's been worked too hard. His chest laboured like a blacksmith's bellows, and his breathing whistled shrilly in his throat. "Better take those choppers out of your mouth, old chap, or else you're going to swallow them. Fighting's over for the day. Take it nice and easy now. We've got a long walk home tonight." And Gareth Swales transferred all his attention back to the disappearing car. "Big-hearted Jake Barton is leaving us here, going home to spoon up the honey. Who was the chap that David pulled the same trick on? Come on, Rassy, you're the Old Testament expert. Who was it, Uriah, the Hittite?" He shook his head sadly. Gareth was always ready to believe the worst. "I take it very much amiss, Rassy, I can tell you. Probably have done exactly the same myself, mind you. But I do take it amiss coming from a fine upright citizen like Jake Barton." The Ras had not listened to a word of it. He was the only man in the two armies for whom the battle had not ended. He was just having a short rest, as behove a warrior of his advanced years. Now, with a single bound, he was on his feet again, snatching up his sword and heading directly for the centre of the Italian batteries. Gareth was taken completely off balance, and the Ras had covered 50 yards of the necessary 2,000 to the enemy positions before Gareth could overtake him. It was unfortunate that one of the Italian gunlayers had his binoculars focused on the derelict hull of the Hump at that moment. The belligerence of the Italian gunners was in inverse proportion to the number and proximity of the enemy, and all of them were giddy with elation at the total and unexpected victory that had dropped into their laps. The first shell dropped close beside the broken hull of the Hump as Gareth caught up with the Ras. Gareth stooped and picked up a rounded stone about the size of a cricket ball. "Frightfully sorry, old chap," he panted, as he cupped the stone in his right hand. "But we really can't go on like this." He made allowance for the brittle old bone of the Ras's skull, and with the stone he tapped him carefully, almost tenderly above the ear, on the polished black bald curve of the Ras's pate. As the Ras dropped, Gareth caught him, one arm under his knees and the other around the shoulders, as though he were a sleeping child. Shells were falling heavily about him as Gareth ran back for cover, carrying the Ras's unconscious form across his chest. Jake Barton heard the crumping explosion of the shells and shouted up at Gregorius, "What are they shooting at now?" Gregorius climbed higher out of the turret and peered back. The crushed hull of the Hump would have been unnoticed at that range, just another speck like a clump of camel thorn or an amorphous pile of black rock. Indeed, both men had looked at it 50 times in the last few minutes without recognizing it. But the shell bursts, which began to leap about it in fleeting, graceful ostrich feathers of dust and smoke, drew Gregorius's eye immediately. "My grandfather!" he called anxiously. "They've been hit, Jake!" Jake swung the car and halted it, clambering out of the hatch, blowing dust from the lens of his binoculars, and then focusing them. The picture of the destroyed car leapt into close-up, and he recognised instantly the two distant figures, one in tailored tweeds, the other in flowing robes and swirling skirts. The two of them were locked together, breast to breast, and for an unbelieving moment, Jake thought they were doing a Strauss waltz in the midst of an artillery barrage. Then he saw Gareth lift the Rouse off the ground and stagger with him to the shelter of the overturned car. "We must rescue them, Jake," Gregorius exclaimed passionately. "They will be killed out there if we do not." Perhaps it was the telepathic transfer of Gareth Swales' suspicions, but Jake experienced the sudden guilty prick of temptation. At that moment, he knew he loved Vicky Camberwell, and there was an easy way to clear the field. "Jake!" Gregorius called again. And suddenly Jake felt himself so sickened by his own treacherous thoughts that there was a hollow, nauseous feeling in the centre of his gut, and he felt the swift flow of saliva from under his tongue. "Let's go," he said, and dropped down into the driver's hatch. He swung Priscilla the pig into a tight, skidding turn and ran straight for the forest of shell bursts. They drew no fire. The Italians were concentrating on the stationary target, and they seemed to be making better practice as they figured the range. It was a matter of seconds before the hump took a direct hit, and Jake pressed the throttle flat to the floorboards, but Priscilla the pig chose this moment to show her true nature. He felt her bulk, and the note of her engine changed momentarily, missing and stuttering, power falling off. Then suddenly she picked up again and roared onwards at full power. "Good little darling." Jake peered ahead through the visor and swung slightly out to the left to come in under the cover of the Italian's own shell bursts and the capsized hull of the hump. A shell burst directly ahead, and Jake weaved the big car expertly round the gaping, smoking crater, pulled in sharply and spun around to a sliding halt, facing back the way he'd come, ready for a quick pull away. He was hard up under cover of the destroyed hull, partially screened from the Italians, and 10 paces from where Gareth Swales was sitting, holding the Russ's frail body on his lap. "Gary!" yelled Jake, sticking his head out of the hatch, and Gareth looked up at him with a startled, unbelieving expression. He'd been so deafened by shell bursts that he'd not realized that Jake had come back for him. Jake had to shout again. "Come on, goddamn you!" At this time, Gareth moved with alacrity. He picked up the Rass like a bundle of dirty laundry and ran with him to the car. A shell burst so close that it almost knocked him off his feet, and stones and clouds of earth splattered against the armored steel. However, Gareth kept his feet and handed up the Rass to the willing hands and loving care of his grandson. "Is he all right?" Greg demanded anxiously. "Hit by a stone. He'll be all right," Gareth grunted, and leaned for an instant against the side of the car, his breathing sobbing painfully in his throat, his hair and moustache thick with white dust, and the sweat cutting deep wet runnels down his filth-caked cheeks. He looked up at Jake. "I thought you weren't coming back," he croaked. "Crossed my mind." Jake reached down and took his hand. He boosted him up the side of the car, and Gareth held his hand for a second longer than was necessary, squeezing slightly. "I owe you one, old son."
"I'll call on you," Jake grinned.
"Anytime. Anytime at all."
At that moment, Priscilla the pig roared heroically, then abruptly backfired in opposition to the Italian shell bursts. Her engine spluttered, surged, farted despairingly, and then fell silent.
"Oh, you son of a bitch," said Jake, with great and passionate feeling. "Not now, please, not now. Reminds me of a girl I knew in Australia." "Later," Jake told him. "Get on the crank handle." "My pleasure, old boy."
And a near miss burst beside them and knocked him off his precarious perch on the sponson. Gareth picked himself up and dusted his lapels fastidiously as he limped to the crank handle. After a full minute at the handle, spinning it like a demented organ grinder with no effect at all, Gareth fell back panting again.
I say, old chap, I'm a bit bushed.
and they changed places quickly. Jake stooped over the crank handle, ignoring the tempest of bursting shells and swirling dust clouds, and the thick muscles in his arm writhed as he spun the crank. "She's dead!" Gareth shouted after another minute. Jake persevered, his face turning darkly red and the veins in his throat swelling into thick blue cords. But at last, even he released the handle with disgust and stepped back, gasping. "The toolkit's under the seat," he said. "You aren't going to do your handyman act here and now?" Incredulously, Gareth made a wide gesture and took in the bloody battlefield, the Italian guns and the bursting shells. "You got a better idea?" Jake asked brusquely. And Gareth looked about him forlornly, suddenly straightening his slumping shoulders, the droop in his mouth lifting into that eternally jaunty grin. "Funny you should ask, old son. Just so happens..." And like a conjurer, he indicated the apparition that appeared, suddenly out of the curtains of leaping dust and fuming cordite. Miss Wobbly slammed to a dead stop beside them, and both hatches flew open. Sarah's dark head appeared in one, and Vicky's golden one in the other. Vicky leaned across to Jake, cupping her hands to her mouth as she shouted in the storm of shellfire. "What's wrong with Priscilla?" And Jake gasped, still red-faced and sweating. "She's thrown one of her fits." "Grab the tow rope," Vicky instructed. "We'll pull you out." The Ethiopian camp swarmed with victorious, swaggering warriors. Their laughter was loud and their voices boastful. Admiring womenfolk, who watched them from the cooking fires, were preparing the night's feast. The big black iron pots bubbled with a dozen varieties of wat, and the smell of spices and meat lay heavily on the evening cool. Vicky Camberwell bent over her typewriter, seated under the flap of her tent, and her long, supple fingers flew at the keys as the words tumbled from her, describing the courage and fighting qualities of a people who, armed only with a sword and horse, had routed a modern army, equipped with all the most fearsome weapons of war. When she was in literary flight, Vicky sometimes overlooked small details that might detract from the dramatic impact of her story. The fact that the biblical warriors of Ethiopia had been supported by armored cars and Vickers machine guns were details of this type, and she ignored them as she ended. "But how much longer can these proud, simple, and gallant people continue to fight off the greedy, lusting hordes of a modern Caesar intent on empire? A miracle happened here today on the plains of Danakil, but the age of miracles is passing, and it is clear even to those who have thrown in their lot with the fair land of Ethiopia that she is doomed, unless the sleeping conscience of a civilized world is aroused, unless the voice of justice rings out clearly, calling to the tyrant, 'Hands off, Benito Mussolini!'" "That's wonderful, Miss Camberwell," said Sarah, leaning over to read the last words, as they tapped out on the roller of the machine. "It makes me want to cry. It's so sad and beautiful." "I'm glad you like it, Sarah. I wish you were my editor." Vicky stripped the page from the machine and checked it swiftly, crossing out a word and inking in another before she was satisfied, and she folded the dispatch into a thick brown envelope and licked the flap. "Are you sure he's reliable?" she asked Sarah. "Oh, yes, Miss Camberwell. He is one of my father's best men." Sarah took the envelope and handed it to the warrior who had been waiting an hour outside the tent, squatting at the head of his saddled horse. Sarah spoke to him with a great fire and passion, and the man nodded vehemently as she exhorted him and then flung himself into the saddle and dashed away towards the darkening mouth of the gorge, where the smoky blue shadows of the evening were enfolding the harsh cliffs and jagged peaks of the mountains. "He will be at Sadi before midnight. I have told him not to pause along the way. Your message will go on the telegraph at dawn tomorrow morning." "Thank you, Sarah, dear." Vicky rose from the camp table, and as she covered her typewriter, Sarah eyed her speculatively. Vicky had bathed and changed into the one good dress she had brought with her, a light Irish linen in a pale blue, cut with a fashionably low waist and skirt that covered her knees, but displayed rounded calves and the narrow, delicately shaped ankles, which gleamed in their sheaths of fine silk stockings.